real information, good conversation, unabashedly Wisconsin. Up North News with Pat Kreitlow starts now.
Well, here we are, and good morning. Welcome to the State of Wisconsin Sense. Think of it as Wisconsin's mid-morning coffee break. You might only need a few minutes to get up to date, or you can hang around for all 3 hours. We don't charge you extra for that. It's Tuesday, October 4th, and we are back live after a long weekend so that young Mr. Mathers, Luke Mathers, our producer, could take the great circle tour of Dakota, having gone through North Dakota, coming back through South Dakota, and save the jokes, because I've taken that drive as well, and I love it. So I'm going to say good morning and ask if you had a good time.
Yeah, it was a great time. I was just doing a little quality assurance test of both I-94 and I-90, because I did pretty long stretches on both of those two.
Oh, yeah, very long stretches, but and monotonous in some parts, but really pretty in the others. Makes it all worth it, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on. Coming up this morning, Hans Breitenmoser on rural Wisconsin issues ahead of the fall election. We will have three more candidates for who are on the November legislative ballot. Let's see, we've got Jane Benson, Hannah Beauchamp Pope, and State Representative Christina Shelton, all in Northeast Wisconsin, all interviewed by our friend Dr. Kristen Lyerly, and we'll be playing that interview back in our next hour. To reach the show, 715-388-7155, or email us radio@upnorthnewswi.com. That's radio@upnorthnewswi.com. Don't forget the WI. You won't hear us have any more false hopes about the Brewers making the postseason. That came to a screeching end, even though the Brewers, again, you know, had this big rally. Let's see, how many walk-offs have they had now? Is it 10? Yeah, 10th walk-off win of the season, 6-5 in 10 innings over Arizona. But about 10 minutes later, the Phillies beat Houston 3-0. And so despite a sixth straight quality start for Brandon Woodruff, the Brewers are out of the postseason picture, even after posting the best 50-game start in franchise history. There were then plenty of injuries, an offense that Todd Rosiak of the Journal Sentinel notes was overly reliant on the homer, and then a bullpen that was once the strength of the club and the talk of the lead became shaky and then thinned with the Josh Hader trade. And so there will be two more regular season games today and tomorrow against Arizona. And then it's time to get out the golf clubs, and we'll start counting the days until spring training.
I already saw the posting of how many days it was.
I get to say it finally to Luke. You're the one who's muted this time. So see if he can bring his mic up for us here.
Can you hear me now? Hear him.
No, not hearing you at all. Oh, it's that thing again. Remember, we had that a couple of weeks back where I can't hear you. I think you had to give me the Zoom host and then reset it or something fun like that. So we'll take care of that during the break. Packers beat New England over the weekend. And then I think a lot of folks are planning this already, but just so that it doesn't catch you off guard, the Packers are in London come Sunday. They are the 32nd and final NFL team that has to give up a home game and have one of their home games be played in London. And, you know, I think that's fine. The Packers have, you know, legendary sellouts. So let's make sure it all works first. And it clearly has for the games that are going there. And so now the Packers will do that. And so the game will start, I believe, around 8:30 on Sunday morning. So I know a couple of my favorite watering holes here in Chippewa Falls around Lake Wissota are opening up early. Apparently, there's going to be a pajama theme in both of them, because I guess some people are still in their pajamas at 8:30 on a Sunday morning. So I'm sure that Kohl's and others are already sold out of any Packer-themed, you know, sweatpants and pajamas that they might have out there. I still not hearing you. See, look, you unplugged the mic and plugged it back in again. It's still nothing from poor Mr. Mathers. In the news headlines, things we'll get into today, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has discovered, a little belatedly in my view, that Derek Van Orden might be a bad guy, might not have the temperament to be a member of Congress. We found out yesterday, Dr. Oz is responsible for killing puppies. And yet he still didn't have the worst day of any of the Republicans running for office in the United States after it was discovered that, you know, he killed puppies as part of lab experiments. Herschel Walker, running as a pro-life, paid for at least one abortion. And the Daily Beast broke the story and made note, we have the receipts. Literally, they literally have the receipts, including a get well card that Herschel Walker sent to the woman. And by the way, not a youthful indiscretion on his part. He was 47 at the time when this happened, I think 2009. We will talk about that later on. One of Donald Trump's lawyers disclosed that he refused to lie when Trump ordered him told him to tell the government that all of the documents had been returned, when that was not the case. And this was long before the search warrant was executed that, you know, discovered that all the documents had not been returned. And it turns out they're still not. And later we will get into Governor Tony Evers making a new budget allocation plan for next year, should he win re-election. A big increase in shared revenue to help fund local government services and public safety and law enforcement. And despite everything that's in the Republican ads, Governor Evers actually does have a solid record to run on in terms of funding law enforcement versus what the Republican legislature has done, which is jack squat. We'll have more after this. You're up north. Joined now by Hans Brighton Moser, who farms up in Lincoln County near Merrill, is active with the Farmers Union, and visits with us every couple of weeks or so to talk about the rural Wisconsin economy and things that are getting done, things that need to be done, who is showing leadership, and who decidedly is not. Hans, good morning. Good to see you.
Good morning. Good to see you, Pat.
Hey, let's talk weather first, because we're right now everything seems rather seasonal, certainly at least here around Lake Wissota. Not a lot of field activity yet, but you can sense it's coming any time now. And so, again, this is our fully informal farm report, because we're not sitting here with charts and graphs and meteorologists and climatologists and everything else. But I'm simply going to say, how's it looking by you?
And once again, as soon as we get started, my internet connection starts to give me grief. So you broke up there, but it sounds like you're trying to talk about the weather. I apologize for not picking up exactly what you're laying down. The weather has been warm and conducive to corn chopping, and as such, we did get our corn chopped last week, and that's all put to bed. So now we're helping on working on the neighbor's corn silage right now.
Okay. No, that's awesome. And yeah, I almost feel like we should always precede your segments with talking about rural broadband. And ironically, my comeback to this would be that here around Lake Wissota, not a ton of field chopping yet. The biggest activity around here has actually been on the periphery of the fields, where the town of Eagle Point used a lot of its American Rescue Plan Act funds to contract for new broadband service. And so trenching companies have been busy along the fields, you know, laying new broadband. And so that kind of leads me right into where I wanted to go next when we talk about the American Rescue Plan, the bipartisan infrastructure bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, the things that people decide, mostly in Washington, but also in Madison, that have an impact on the farm in Wisconsin. 2 weeks ago, we talked about the Farm Bill, and you were in Washington, D.C., on behalf of the National Farmers Union, the Wisconsin Farmers Union, talking about priorities for the 2023 Farm Bill. And that is all fine and good and very relevant. But I think it's fair to say that 2022, given those pieces of legislation that the Biden administration got passed, 2022 seems to me to have been a productive year legislative-wise for the rural economy as well.
Yeah, I think so. I think that the Inflation Reduction Act is something that is helpful for rural America, and we'll see that down to the local government level. It is important to things that you just mentioned, for broadband, for example. These are the types of things that we need in rural America, and they don't just magically happen. They have to have support in Washington. The funds have to get there. And then, you know, go ahead and execute. And a lot of this stuff, like conservation programming and so forth, you know, it takes legislation at the federal level to get that done. But we also need to think beyond that, because it also takes staff to get these things executed. And so when we start talking about conservation programs and so forth, it's only as good as the amount of folks in the offices to help execute the programs as well.
I have to say that's always been a sore point with me, is that so often it seems, at least over the past, you know, generation, basically, that, you know, we have Republican administrations that tend to make a mess of things. Eventually, Democrats are elected to mop things up. They pass legislation. But as you just noted, it takes a while for those things to take effect. And because they don't take effect instantly, you then have Republicans in the next cycle going, oh, look, Democrats didn't get anything done. And then Republicans come in and at first reap the benefits of Democratic action. And then, you know, they put Jell-O in the radiator, you know, or whatever the case may be. So I think it's important that we note these things that got passed this year and then are going to take effect. You know, we're not seeing, bridges are not going to be built in, you know, towns across Wisconsin because of the bipartisan infrastructure bill. But because of the American Rescue Plan, there is money that's already being spent across, you know, rural Wisconsin and bringing real benefits now, not just to the biggest cities, but to the smallest towns, right?
Yeah, I think that's true. And it is unfortunate. I think you're right as far as it's politics du jour. And I think we've always seen that a little bit in this country where, you know, politicians will happily take credit for things that they perhaps voted against, you know, in a previous cycle. But I think we have that on steroids now. I mean, now we have really one party that's actively working against, you know, getting some things done to make the other party look bad, rather than look at things and say, hey, you know, there's work to be done. Let's get it done and let's leave the politics aside. And I think that's, you know, that's just the difference between electing politicians and electing, you know, leaders and public servants. And I think when we go out to vote, we have to, you know, we have to keep that in mind. It, you know, as a person we're voting for, merely a politician who likes the idea of, you know, being in Congress or the Senate or what have you, or are they in fact there because they care about, you know, the people that live, you know, out, you know, in the countryside and in the cities and so forth. And I really feel like that's something that as we choose our elected officials, we can sort of think about that when in terms of, you know, what are their backgrounds? Look at these people's backgrounds. And I feel like in the past, you know, X number of years, and perhaps it's always been this way in American politics to a certain extent, but, you know, it is interesting sometimes when you get, you know, some uber rich people who've you know, made lots of money and sort of are, you know, worn out with the challenge of just being rich. Now they have to have a title like, you know, senator or governor. and I think it's important to look at people's backgrounds and say, where did they come from? Because that will, I think, guide their decisions on, you know, the legislation that they try and pursue and write. Because they're surrounded by people and have been surrounded by people who are closer to the ground, perhaps.
Yeah, we're talking to Hans Breitenmoser about the rural economy in Wisconsin and action that has been taking place and the way that resources are allocated from the big pieces of legislation we hear about in Congress and to a lesser degree in the legislature, and then how that is actually put into action at the local level, right down to the farm level. One of the things that Governor Evers talks about in terms of distributing pandemic aid, and, you know, he and all the states received a lot of it. It was a very important economic stimulus bill to keep the American economy from collapsing during the early months of the coronavirus pandemic. And the governor notes that, you know, at least $100 million has been directed in that pandemic aid to support some 20,000 Wisconsin farmers through the Farm Support Program. Direct support has exceeded $1 million to farmers in more than half of the counties. Support that helps farmers pay bills, invest in equipment, and continue feeding and fueling Wisconsin and the world are the words that Governor Evers is using to talk about that. Hans, can you talk a bit about that, either that support program or the other things that in the absence of, you know, robust markets, especially global markets, this kind of support is essential for Wisconsin farmers to stay above water?
Yeah, well, and I think these support type programs are well received. They're certainly well intentioned, and they do help. But I would only I'm very supportive of the governor's efforts here. But I think we also sometimes need to step back, Pat, and look at that bigger picture, and look at the reasons why taxpayer dollars are going to support small businesses like farmers. You know, I mean, we're hemorrhaging dairy farmers in the state of Wisconsin, the dairy state, and that should concern us, because that's not only an economic issue, but that's sort of a social fabric issue. Losing dairy farms across the state at the rate that we have been has definitely an impact on our small communities. We've had this conversation before. It speaks to the number of schools. It speaks to the number of taverns. It speaks to the number of churches. So it is a fabric thing. But again, we have to step back and say, why do we have the prices that we have when there are plenty of people who are hungry around the world? We have to ask, are these programs subsidizing farmers? Really, in a roundabout way, subsidizing big agribusiness that has been pushing farm gate prices down, and so then the taxpayer has to come in and come up with programs to help keep farmers afloat. That I think should be the bigger concern, and that's only, you know, at the state level we can only do so much about that. At the federal level, that's where we could actually have some teeth and have some impact.
We really could if we had, and again, you have a Senate, for example, that is designed to be more heavily represented by rural states, but because so many of those senators are Republican and choose, you know, the quote unquote free market approach over taking care of their own farmers at home, you end up having, instead of the local bank that wants to, you know, keep farm loan money in the local economy, you now have big banks that are looking to maximize profits, you know, across an entire nation or world, and not necessarily keep those local dollars at home. And the same goes for those big agribusinesses. But it is, you know, it's an important point you raise about, you know, the short-term support. And I'm not quibbling with that, though I'd note everything from PPP loans to the Restaurant Revitalization Fund, you know, which was designed, of course, just for restaurants, and a host of other things that, you know, at least farmers didn't get left behind in that notion of, hey, we're in a crisis. We need to, you know, support every type of small business, including farms. And yeah, then, like you said, in the 2023 Farm Bill, maybe we can get to the point where we're taking care of, you know, farmers rather than the farm industry.
Yeah. Yep. No. And the things that you mentioned, PPP and so forth, again, very important to all sorts of small businesses, whether they're in rural areas or urban areas. I mean, I can only speak to the rural parts of things, but yeah, to get those dollars into communities and bouncing around into communities, I think that was that just made sense, because again, the closer you get those dollars to the ground, the more they're going to reproduce quickly, right? So that was, that kind of infusion makes sense in an emergency situation. But I do feel like we should be able to walk and chew gum at the same time, right? We put out that fire, we put out the symptom of something, but then we also continue to work on the cause of the problem, the root cause of the problem, and sort of that, the big picture extraction that we've seen in the rural economies for the past, you know, how many decades now, to really tackle that extraction. And I think the banking part of it, that's an important consideration too. I mean, whenever we can work with local credit unions where those dollars stick in our communities is going to have a positive impact on those communities. And that doesn't mean, again, you know, subsidizing local, but it does mean making sure that big international businesses aren't getting all the advantages given to them by our federal government.
Yep. More with Hans Breitenmoser after this break. You're up north.
Real information, good conversation, unabashedly Wisconsin. You're listening to Up North News.
Now, I'm not telling you today is going to be the last great day of fall, because fall is only like about, you know, 6 hours old or something like that. But a front's going to come through, and there's going to be rain or sprinkles in large parts of the state, moving from west to east, of course. And that cold front is going to really drop temperatures Thursday, Friday, into Saturday. Things will recover after that. But, you know, again, very seasonal stuff that I think a lot of farmers count on, depend on, frankly. And Hans Breitenmoser joins us again to talk a bit more about that. Hans, we were talking about markets and expanding markets. And what you see in a lot of these proposals from Congress, for example, is talking about finding new market opportunities for agriculture overseas, finding new global markets. And at the state level, we talk about finding new markets locally. I'm assuming by that, we're talking about things like helping smaller producers, like smaller meat producers who can find markets that the big boys, the big four meat processing companies can't find. But can you talk more about what it means for policy that wants to expand into and find new markets?
Sure. Yeah, I think both concepts make sense. I think it's in every country does this that produces ag products, right? They're all looking to foreign markets to see where they can expand. It's in the dairy industry's interest, of course, to see if we can move product to China and other countries, especially countries that don't historically have a tradition of consuming dairy products. But I think when we start talking about local markets, that is so very important because of the trend that our ag and our agribusiness has gone in this country, which is to make larger and larger processing plants, whether those are cheese plants or meat processing plants or what have you, larger and larger, fewer and farther between. And so then what that ends up, one of the issues that creates is that we've got, you know, too many eggs in one basket. So when we see issues with a pandemic, for example, like we have seen, that creates a definite problem. These systems work efficiently when they work, and when a black swan flies in, the wheels fall completely off. So we've favored bigger processing over the cost of transportation, because obviously the more regionalized we have these systems, the more these products have to get on wheels to get back to the people that are going to consume them. So I think, again, it gets back to not just supporting local ag, but also understanding why local ag struggles. And if you use the meatpacking example, if we don't enforce antitrust legislation and we don't improve antitrust legislation, we don't have competition, and we end up having issues with both consumers and producers because there's such a monopolized middleman. So we're looking really for increased competition and more local availability for some things like meat packing, for example. It's nearly impossible to get any, we have to make an appointment a year in advance with any local processor to get a cow butchered in our area. That just tells me that there's way more demand than there is supply to take care of it. So that's sort of one example of some of the things that we're concerned about at the local farm gate level.
Yeah, no, that it makes perfect sense. And it leads to this question. When I looked back at the Farmers Union lobbying list, I'll call it, in D.C. recently. There were a couple of things I wanted to ask you about or get updates about. Second one we'll do is country of origin labeling. I can't believe that is still a thing. But I want to start with what's noted here as the Packers and Stockyards Act. And I'm wondering if that is some kind of a COVID follow-up where so many meatpacking plants basically had to shut down. They did not take proper safeguards with their employees. That's purely a guess on my part, showing my ignorance that I didn't do my homework for this particular question. But can you tell us about the Packers and Stockyards Act?
Yeah, I mean, it's not... again, I think when you have a pandemic like COVID, it only exacerbates issues that already exist, or it exposes issues and exposes weaknesses, and I think this is sort of one of them. You know, the Packers and Stockyards Act is 100 year old, but it, you know, and the whole idea behind it was excuse me, to make sure that you know, we have competitive markets so that it's and we have transparency, so that we don't have packers that are taking advantage of both consumers and producers. So the Packers and Stockyards Act has been around for some time, but it needs some enforcement. You know, it needs stronger enforcement, and that takes, you know, frankly, I mean, I think sometimes when you talk about laws that are on the books and needing enforcement, that takes political will as well. But it's basically, we need to update it and improve it because, you know, things have changed in 100 years. And so therefore, we have to update legislation sometimes, too, and not just, you know, it's on the books, but it needs to be enforced and it needs to be updated.
Yeah. And you know, when we talk about helping with markets, you can take the sledgehammer approach like, you know, former President Trump did with China, which only ended up, you know, hurting a lot of American agriculture producers. But you can't forget that along with, you know, adversarial relations with other countries, you might have adversarial conditions with, you know, mega-sized corporations and how they are treating the farmers who supply the products that they're moving around the country. And it is interesting, this theme that we keep coming back to about competition, that farmers don't mind competition. They know it's, you know, part of the whole nature of what they're doing, but at least let's have elected officials who understand the concept of a level playing field.
Yeah, you were breaking up there something terrible again, Pat. I apologize, but the gist of it is, I think you're correct. I mean, farmers aren't anti-competition. We're big fans, but the interesting, you know, the arguments that have been made in the name of capitalism are, you know, supporting ideas that are very anti-capitalistic, which is to say, anti-competitive. I mean, if we're capitalists, then I think we're interested in having competition, and anything that stifles competition, we should you know, make sure we minimize, right? And so we're talking about monopolistic type practices here that we need to regulate at the federal level to encourage competition, not to discourage competition, but to encourage competition. And in terms of trade with, you know, using the China example, I really feel like, and maybe this is just me being a simplistic minded farmer, but it's, you know, competition amongst the countries is great and so forth, and we have to look out for our own best interests, obviously. But I also think that there's a certain amount of, we should be operating at the global level, sort of how we operate in our neighborhood, right? I mean, anybody who's been in business for a while understands that when you make a deal, it has to be good for both parties so that you can go back to that table again and make another deal in the future. Any deals that are made that are completely one-sided are not going to, you know, result in long-term relationships. And so while we definitely have to have our hand on our wallet when we're dealing with China or any other country, I think we also need to realize that there are a lot of you know, there are a lot of folks in China who we could potentially be selling some products to. And we want to maintain a good trade relationship. And I think these good trade relationships also ultimately end, can result in good, political relationships and that type of stuff. And we have to remember that, the Chinese government is an authoritarian police state. It's very top down. But the average, person in China is just like you and I, Pat. They are concerned about having a decent job. They're wanting to make sure that their kids are getting an education. They want to have a roof over the head. And so if trade can help with that, if we can buy a few things from China and we can sell a few things to China, then I think if we look at it really down at that human personal level, there's no reason why we have to have an antagonistic relationship.
Right. And all we need is to make sure, again, that, of course, multinational corporations are going to be a part of this mix. And of course, as soon as a company becomes a multinational, they're looking out for their bottom line more so than, either their suppliers in the United States or their buyers in China. So I note from a Reuters news article about this in May, the USDA proposed a rule that would require poultry companies to be more transparent with contract chicken growers to protect them better. In February, JBS, one of the big meatpacking companies, agreed to pay $52 million to settle litigation accusing meatpacking companies of conspiring to limit supply in the U.S. beef market in order to inflate prices and boost profits. And separately, executives who worked for Pilgrim's Pride and another poultry producer were accused of fixing prices in the poultry sector in the most recent year. So, yeah, you're right to say that it's one thing to be focused on China, but again, farmers first have to work with these corporations. And if they're members of Congress, aren't looking out for them, and instead of looking out for companies that pull garbage like this, the farmer is always going to be behind the eight ball.
Absolutely. And the consumer, and it's not helpful for the consumers either. So I think you're right. I mean, but I think when it comes to our politicians, and again, we're talking politicians instead of, leaders, it's easy to create a boogeyman that's sort of, easy to point out. And it's a little more difficult to talk about some of these more complicated issues, like antitrust legislation. That tends to be a little wonkier and a little more dull, but it's far more insidious and does far more damage. And like you correctly stated, I think in years past we had big companies that were domestic companies doing some of these types of things, but now these are international corporations, and I think that should concern us even more, because it does not only speak to farm gate prices, and farm gate prices speak directly to the quality of local economies and so forth. But it does speak to food security, and it does speak to national security at such a basic level. So we really need to make sure that our legislators at the federal level and the administration is concerned about that. And not just going along because this is how we've done it, or worse, going along because, let's face it, some of these organizations and companies are greasing politicians and putting money into political campaigns, and that's where it starts, I feel.
No doubt. We've got a couple minutes to ask about country of origin labeling. Can you explain what that is and how Wisconsin farmers are impacted and what should be happening with that?
Yeah, so I mean, country of origin labeling, or COOL, just sort of speaks to where a product comes from. And there have been, at the risk of sounding old-fashioned, there have been shenanigans. I feel like that's a word that you would use more.
It totally works for me. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, all right. So, but there have been shenanigans because again, you've got multinational companies that are trying to market their products in obviously in our grocery stores, saying, okay, well, this is an American product. Well, it may or may not be, depending on how you look at it. And so beef has been one where there can be some ambiguity whether that beef comes from the United States or not. If it comes from another country and gets repackaged into the United States and is labeled as American beef, obviously that's not, you know, that's just not honest. And so that's one of the things that Farmers Union has been concerned about, is to make sure that consumers understand what in fact they are buying. And it really just comes down to transparency. There's exactly. No reason why consumers shouldn't understand where their food comes from and have a good understanding of that. I think that's only reason.
There you go. Hans Breitenmoser, it's always great to talk to you. We'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks.
Thank you, Pat.
Have a great day. We'll wrap up this hour after this. You're up north. Just imagine, as I said at the top of the hour, and as other people are saying as well, imagine being a candidate for the United States Senate, and you're not running a great campaign as it is, and it is revealed that you were part of laboratory experiments that led to the traumatic deaths of more than 300 dogs, including entire litters of puppies, as part of various experiments. Imagine you're that politician who literally kills puppies, and you're still not having the worst day of all the Republicans running for U.S. Senate. And yeah, we'll get back to Ron Johnson later. I got stuff to say later in the program. But again, he didn't come close to having the worst day yesterday. But neither did Dr. Oz, puppy killer. It was instead down in Georgia where Herschel Walker, for whom I should have nothing but pity. This is an unwell man that has been thrust into the spotlight by Donald Trump and others. I should feel more pity, but he didn't have to say yes. Herschel Walker did say yes, and not only did he say yes, he's saying all kinds of weird things on the trail, some of them absolutely incoherent, and some of them contradictory, and some of them hypocritical, like talking about how he is quote-unquote pro-life and does not favor abortion exceptions for rape or incest or life of the mother, but apparently he believes in an exception for Herschel Walker, because the Daily Beast broke the story yesterday that Walker, who says he wants to completely ban abortions, carved out an exception for himself when a woman talked about how she and Walker conceived a child while dating in 2009, again, when he was in his 40s. He urged her to get an abortion. The woman said she had the procedure. Walker reimbursed her for it. She supported the claim with the $575 receipt from the abortion clinic, along with a bank deposit receipt that included an image of a signed personal check from Walker and a get well card that Herschel Walker sent her. You know, the woman said that Walker, who was not married at the time, told her it would be more convenient to terminate the pregnancy, saying it was, quote, not the right time for him to have a child. And if that was the story, that would be enough. But you now have Herschel Walker's son, who went on what could only be described as a rage tweet, blasting his father. Starting with, quote, every family member of Herschel Walker, every family member asked him not to run for office because we all knew some of his past, every single one. His son goes on to say he decided to give us the middle finger and air out all of his dirty laundry in public while simultaneously lying about it. I'm done. And then he had a few more words to say about, you know, you're not a family man. You left us to bang a bunch of women, threatened to kill us, and had us move more than six times in 6 months running from your violence. Christian Walker went on to say, I don't care about someone who's had a bad past and takes accountability, but how dare you lie and act as though you're some moral Christian upright man. You've lived a life of destroying other people's lives. How dare you? Herschel Walker's response simply said, I love my son no matter what. Well, the no matter what in this case is a big one. So that was Herschel Walker, Republican candidate for Senate. We've talked about Dr. Oz, Republican candidate for Senate, and the disclosure of what he was up to in the past. And then this morning, we have the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel commenting on or doing an article on a Republican candidate for Congress here in Wisconsin. And the headline on the article from Lauren Sandrea says, quote, a thin skin. Questions over Derek Van Orden's temperament color the race for a key Wisconsin congressional district. And it goes on to explain the many instances where he has said things on Twitter or in person or his actions that really make clear that people question whether he has the temperament and the judgment to be a congressman, to represent Wisconsin. What stuck out for me, and I'm not going to completely slam the Journal Sentinel on this, but I'm going to put it out there. Midway through the article, it says Van Orden's campaign did not respond to several Journal Sentinel interview requests over the span of more than 2 months, which tells me what I strongly suspect, and I strongly think I'm right, is that this article could have come out much earlier. I'm not going to say 2 months earlier, but all of these things were out there. But where was the media coverage about them? It always had to be Brad Paff says, his Democratic opponent, or other people say. And obviously enough research has been done that now a reporter can say, this is Derek Van Orden's record. But it, you know, by Van Orden, you know, basically trying to run off the clock on this, he could run that many more commercials trying to show him to be just, you know, your nice guy next door, ordinary guy who served in the military, not at all talking about the rage tweets, the threats, the unhinged behavior, you know, at a public library over an LGBTQ book display. You know, those things don't come up in commercials. Those are things where, and you can't just rely on an opponent to bring them up in commercials or something. If you're going to cover the race, you have to cover the whole race, soup to nuts, including not saying that Van Orden and Brad Paff are sparring about whether to debate, but call it what it is, that Derek Van Orden is avoiding debates. He is, again, trying to run out the clock because he understands that the polling currently makes it look like Van Orden would win this district after Ron Kind represented it for 26 years. And if it were simply going back to another moderate Republican like Steve Gunderson, who represented the district for many years before Ron Kind, that would be one thing. And that is what Derek Van Orden is trying to get out there, that he is going to be another moderate Republican in that district. When, again, it doesn't take much to see that he would, as Congressman Mark Bocan puts so well, make Marjorie Taylor Greene look like a moderate. This is somebody who is supportive of the insurrection, who is antithetical to democracy. And if he's in Congress next year and in the following year, when it comes time for the House to take up certifying the next presidential election, you believe Derek Van Orden is going to be on the side of democracy and respecting the will of the voters? Probably not, based on his record. And so I'm glad the Journal Sentinel article is out. It should have been out sooner. We'll take a break and talk to some legislative candidates from Northeast Wisconsin next. You're up north.